not just anybody.
Help!
You know I need someone.
Help!
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another award-winning episode of Real Recovery. We are underway officially. Looking forward to a great show tonight, George. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Bill. I am, too.
We've got 4 minutes of solid material tonight. We're going to try to stretch
it to 58. Stretch it to 60, yeah.
Yeah, that's what we got. We go with what we have.
I like that a lot. Did you have a good holiday?
I had a nice holiday. I had plenty of good food, fellowship. What about you? Let's move on. Alex, how about you? He doesn't have a microphone. George, you go ahead. Say something.
I wanted to hear about it. I had a great time down at my sister's, and I'm always thankful at this time of year, number one, that I'm still alive, number two, that I'm saved, and number three, that I'm sober. It's a really a great time of year to be grateful about all the things that we take for granted sometimes.
And I've got a passage from Psalm I'd like to read right now. Know that the Lord is God. This is Psalm 100. Know that the Lord is God. It is he who made us, and we are his. We are his people, the sheep of his pasture. Isn't that comforting?
What psalm was that, Bill?
Psalm 100, verse 3.
Like that a lot.
Now I'll read it again, because we have time to kill.
We do. Why don't you read it a couple times, just so it sinks in?
Then I'll read it first in English, then in Greek, because I know it in Greek. Know that the Lord is God. It is he who made us, and we are his. We are his people, the sheep of his pasture. It's a great verse. Very comforting. And in Proverbs 18:10, it says, the name of the Lord is a strong tower. The righteous run to it and are safe. And I think when you are dealing with the subject of addiction of any kind and recovery, you need a safe place to run to.
Well, we find out our way doesn't work. We want to be our own decision makers. We want to be our own gods, and we don't want to live for God. And then that day comes when we're hoping and praying that there really is a God because our way didn't work. And the truth is Jesus is there for us.
Well, Alex has got a microphone now. Let's find out how your holiday went, Alex.
Oh, it was wonderful. I ate till I was in pain.
Good.
So it's how it should be.
Good.
Yeah.
And, George, your sister did call, and she said you did stay too long. But she's not mad.
Oh, okay, good.
No, so that's good.
Don't want to get her mad, Bill. A lot of weapons down there.
Yeah. So what steps do we have tonight, George? We have a great show, first of all. Let's back it up a little bit.
We do.
Back it up. We've got a great guest in studio tonight, as always. We have... person with a powerful story that's going to encourage our listeners. His name is Paul. That's all the hint I'm giving you right now. That's what I call a cliffhanger.
That's a real Christian name, Paul.
It is. It's a cliffhanger, though.
Okay.
Because I'm going to tell you his last name later.
I think I know.
I know you know, but...
What our show's about, if you're listening for the first time or a regular listener, we call it Real Recovery because we believe that all Christians... are in recovery. Recovery from our old way of life. And we believe addiction and all sinful behavior is really idolatry. And recovery without Jesus Christ is still idolatry. So maybe you haven't had a drink in a long time. Maybe you've got a 30-year medallion in your pocket. Congratulations. But if you don't have Jesus, you don't have forgiveness of your sins and you don't have eternal life. And that's what we want to talk about. Every week we do a step. This week we have steps 8 and 9 where we made a list of all people we had harmed and become willing to make amends to them all. And then we make direct amends wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. We don't want to be selfish trying to make ourselves feel good. We want to take care of our side of the street, Bill.
I agree.
And so that's what we do. Where can I make this right? And for us as Christians, we've been given a new life. If we're really sorry about what we did, we don't do it anymore, and we try to help other people. So if you have the good news of Jesus Christ in your life, you want to share that, and you want to love your brother, and you want to help people and do things that God would have you do. And I think that's the important part of these steps for me, Bill, is to try to, you know, lead a Christian life and try to be helpful rather than hurtful.
You used that word try a couple of times. What about... how we train ourselves to live a Christian life.
That's very important. What are you doing daily to, you know, increase your walk with the Lord? Are you in the Word? Are you praying?
Are you in community? Are you in fellowship? And it's a training. It's a process where you can rely on your training and not just get out and try every day. Because when you try, you often put yourself at risk of failure, and then failure turns into guilt, and then guilt turns into, I'm going to try harder, and then trying harder turns into another failure, which turns into more guilt, which turns into more shame, I'm going to try harder. And that's a cycle of insanity.
Absolutely. I think Jesus said it best. You got to pick up your cross and deny yourself daily.
George, what about when our old ways creep into our current life? How do we deal with that?
You mean like every day?
Mm-hmm.
I think we recognize it and pray about it. For me, my drinking, my drugging, my anger, my lust, my greed, I have to pray for the desire to not want to do these things, not want to carry it out. There's a voice in my head that says, you know, George, you've made a lot of progress, a lot better than you used to be. You're okay. And that's not the voice from God. That's selfish, and it's all about me. And every day, Bill, I have to pray for sobriety. I have to pray for the desire and the power to carry out what God wants me to do.
Are you a positive person, or do you kind of have a negative attitude about stuff?
Depends on who I'm around, Bill. Why do you ask? Yeah, I think normally I'm pretty positive because my life is so much better than it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
How about you?
Well, I think I have a little bit of a dark cloud hanging over me at times.
Oh, really?
A little bit of one.
Yeah, it's a little one.
Yeah, it's a little one. I can lean towards melancholy at times. But I think basically I'm a pretty optimistic guy. I think I try anyway.
I think you do.
Yeah, I do.
Really nice sweater, by the way.
Thanks. I got this in London. Thought I'd name drop. I went to Harrods on the sale rack.
A rack at Harrods. No, it's nice. It's hard to be
George,
positive.
Rough topic.
It's hard to be positive.
I think we should do a show.
If you don't have God in your life.
I agree.
Because it's all circumstantial then, isn't it?
Yes.
I'm happy because the stock market's up. Actually, I'm a little scared because I think it's too high, but that's a whole other show. My happiness and my joy doesn't depend on my circumstances. It depends on my relationship with Jesus. And that's not going to change for the worse. I'm going to get closer and closer and closer. If it's dependent on me, I'm in a lot of trouble.
Mm-hmm. I think there should be a show topic coming up in the future where we talk about an addiction to negativity, an addiction to bad feelings about yourself. I think there's a lot of people that do so much bad self-talk that it literally eats up their emotional capital every day, and they've got nothing to give because they're so busy looking inward.
Well, it's safer to be negative. You don't get let down.
Well, explain that.
I think for a lot of us, when we're really in trouble, I know when I was drinking and doing cocaine, it was really easy for me to be negative because then I'm not going to, you know, have my feet knocked out from under me. That's my existence.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of a fear of success in that, you know, everything you do turns out bad. So this is comfortable and it's safe and I have an excuse to be a kind of a loser. It's who I am,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's victim-y.
The safer place to live, isn't it?
It's very victim-y.
Mm-hmm.
And I think
is that a word, victim-y?
It is now, Bill, on this show. For our third caller, we'll give him a free oil change.
Really?
Yeah, we could do that.
Yeah.
Maybe not. Okay. I don't know. How do you feel about it? Don't you think, you know, victims don't change? I'm responsible. And if I'm really negative and things are bad, I can go, poor me, poor me.
Yeah. Yeah, I got nothing on that.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's because you're such a positive person, you know?
No, the whole victim mentality is, I see really prevalent in the recovery community. The guys that I'm working with, they are world-class victims.
You bet.
And the first thing they'll do is they'll give you a reason why their life is so terrible or why they're in the situation they're in, and they never seem to say, look, it was me. I goofed up. I'll take the blame.
Well, you read that verse out of Proverbs a lot about how we go our own way and then blame God for the problems.
I think it's 19:3. It says something like, I'll paraphrase here, a man will blow up his own life and then be mad at God.
Sure.
Yeah.
And our relationship with God can be, I'll be with God, but I want this girl or this job or that. And then when we don't get that, then I don't want to have anything to do with God. And the whole time I was using God to serve me rather than me serving God.
We're mercenaries. We want stuff from God. We're just mercenaries.
Yep. Negotiators.
Well, yeah. Yeah. We are negotiators. It's stupid. There you go, George.
I don't know who you're looking at when you said that,
I don't know.
I think I know who you are.
I'm looking at you.
I know you are.
Yeah.
I'm not that stupid. I know who you're looking at.
Yeah.
And I think what happens is we finally do break down and get to the point where we're desperate enough. We get that gift of desperation where we're willing to change. And I think that comes from the Holy Spirit, Bill, that this way isn't going to work and there is a way that will.
Right. And the quickest way to get out of a hole is to stop digging.
Cliche number one tonight.
Yes, tonight. Anyway, we are two guys genetically designed to be on the radio. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to bring our guest in studio on the air. This is one you're not going to want to miss.
Absolutely.
You're listening to Real Recovery with Bill Arnold and George Frieza. Faith Radio. We'll be back in a minute.
Life is dull. It's nothing but one big lull. Then presto, you do a skull.
Welcome back, everybody, to Real Recovery. George, half of the population is below average. That's a comfortable place for us to live, isn't it?
And I represent those people well, Bill.
Now, you've got the eye of the tiger tonight, George. I'm impressed.
I'm very excited about the show tonight, Billy.
As you should be, as am I. Let's get started.
Who's our guest?
You go ahead. Do the honors.
Our good friend Paul Walser is with us tonight. Paul, how you doing?
Doing great. Speaking of below average, I'm the right guest.
We got to. It's below average.
You're in good company, my friend.
Yeah. I'm real recovering. I'm really glad you agreed to do the show. I've known Paul. Bill, I think you've known Paul for a long time. And Paul, you've had a lot of success in your life. And we want to start off talking about, what was your childhood like?
I had a good childhood. I didn't have a family that was faithful necessarily. I had my mom came from a Catholic background, and my father's parents were Christian Scientists. But we never really worshipped at all. It started off with my older brother and I, and then we had adopted brother and sister that came about their 10 years, my junior, 10 and 13. But you know, it was a good family life generally. My folks ultimately got divorced.
How old were you when they got divorced?
I had just graduated high school. So back in the time that you and I knew each other, George, I was 18.
You're about 24?
Yeah, you're right around 24. Yeah. 18. And, I'll tell you just a quick story if you don't mind it, because you mentioned the growing up thing in the Catholic, piece with my parents. My mom was required to attend the Catholic Church, and my grandparents, her parents, lived in California. And so when they came into town, we had to put on the church show and pretend that we were, of course, going to Catholic Church every single week. And I recall one time I had just turned 16, and we had moved into the house that you knew me at, George, over in Edina there, and it was decided that my grandmother and my mom and I would go to church on Sunday morning, the three of us together. And so we got up in the morning, we hopped in the car, and of course I was 16, so I had to drive. So I got in the driver's seat immediately, opened the garage door, drove out the driveway, and it occurred to me I had no idea where the church was. And my mother and my grandma were in the back seat. And I'm trying to catch my mom's eye in the rearview mirror to kind of let her know, hey, I don't know where I'm going. Anyway, I made three or four or five turns, happened to be all the right ones. My mom finally figured out that I was up there panicking. She said, don't worry, Mom, the church is right up here on the right-hand side. So God led me right to the church right from the beginning.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
That's a great story.
So you didn't go to church a lot growing up?
Never did, really. Only when my grandparents were in town from California. That was it.
Did you know a lot of people around you who went to church, or was that pretty normal to not go?
I was kind of hanging around the same folks you were, George. I don't recall a lot of them being regular.
I wasn't trying to knock you down, Annie, but
no,
yeah, it really wasn't a big part of our lives.
It really
was it?
Wasn't. Not at all, no.
And our lives were good, and so we really didn't have time for God, and things were fine.
Well, we had everything already figured out, of course. You know, we had all the answers, so
absolutely.
Why search any further?
So after high school, where did you go?
I went to school to Drake University for 5 years then came back and immediately went to work. And, you know, so I've been back in Minnesota ever since.
What business were you in back then?
Well, I was I went to work for my dad right out of college.
Okay.
And he had, at the time, I think there was two car dealerships, and so I went to work for him.
And you worked at the car dealerships when you were in high school, didn't you?
I did.
Okay, because I remember we could always get cars, and you always had a nice car, and that was
didn't
kind of
always treat them respectfully, but we did have cars.
You could drive, yes.
You
could have been a stunt driver. But so things are going well. You graduate. You're working at the car dealership. Were you drinking? Were you partying? Were you just like an average 23, 24-year-old guy?
I learned how to drink pretty well in college. And I didn't discontinue when I got out, so I was I went at it pretty good for a number of years there, and worked hard. That was something that I enjoyed, and I would say came with relative ease. I was fairly good at that, so I was successful at selling cars, and you know, kind of learned the management side of the business, and worked a lot of hours. And when I wasn't working, then I was running around with my friends and doing what too many young kids do.
Fairly good salesman would be very humble, Bill. Paul's one of the best salesmen I've ever met, and I used to be a marketing guy. What was interesting to me about growing up with you and knowing you was you knew how to pick your spots. And a lot of us didn't. And what I mean by that is you could go out and have a few with the boys, but then I got to work tomorrow. I'm going to go home. And you always managed to do that, and there were a few of us and some of my friends now that are in recovery that weren't able to do that. But your life was pretty successful all the way through, wasn't it? You got good grades. You got a good job. Business was good.
I wasn't a great student, George, but I and I've had my ups and downs in business. I don't want to create a false impression here, but generally that, you know, I have been very blessed on the business side. It has been good.
How long after college did you get married, Paul?
I was 34. I met my wife when we were when I was 32, and so you know, I graduated in when I was 22, I suppose, so about 12 years afterwards.
Okay. Were you going to church when you met your wife?
No. I didn't know where the churches were.
Okay. Okay.
And she came, and her background, George, she was, her family, two very faithful people. I love them to death. They're from Mason City, Iowa, and her mom is, evangelical Christian, and her father is very, very deep in his Catholic faith. But they are both awesome people, and they had a tremendous, influence on me early on, right from meeting them.
How did that happen?
How did I meet them? Or
how did the influence happen?
Well, I think one thing is that they were concerned about their daughter probably marrying, you know, a used car salesman without a faith. That wasn't the dream that they had for their daughter. But they never said that to me, by the way. They couldn't have been greater about it. And but I was really attracted to who they were. They had a wonderful marriage, still do. Solid people, grounded. You know, just very giving, very much like my wife, where they always think about everybody other than themselves. And I was kind of sitting here going, you know, how does this work exactly? I've always pretty much thought about me first, and it seems like they think about others first. And so I was wondering about that whole thing. But they were amazing, and my wife was amazing, and I was really drawn to everything I was seeing.
Well, opposites attracted.
Well, that's right,
that's
Bill.
It.
I mean, I think that's true.
I think it's important, Bill, when we see something we want in order to change. We work with a lot of drug addicts and alcoholics, Paul. And what we see is we want them to meet guys that aren't using, that are happy, that have something they want. And it sounds like you saw them and they had something you wanted. What did you do to try to get some of that?
You're talking about
her parents
now?
Right, yeah.
Well, one of the things I decided was, you know, I wasn't, of course, going to make the faith commitment early on. That was a whole nother journey. But I think that her dad was a pilot. And so I thought, well, that's maybe the secret. I'll just go fly airplanes. And so I went and got my pilot's license. And that became a significant event for me in terms of my ultimate faith journey. But so that was one of the things I did. And then I tried to emulate her father in a lot of respects. He's a very outdoorsy guy, a fisherman, hunter, that sort of thing. And so I got a fishing boat and, you know, I started to kind of try to be a little bit more like him because I really looked up to him. And her as well. She was a very conversant and would sit down and talk for hours on end. And she was very easy to talk to, always has been. Unfortunately, sometimes she'll literally sit and talk to you all night long. She's a night owl. And so she'll talk and talk and talk, but it was always easy to communicate with her. I never found that kind of ease in communicating with somebody. She's just great. And she and her sister were the same way. In fact, I remember one of the first times I was down in Mason City, and they were having a conversation on the phone, and they would talk for a long time on the phone. And so it was about 10:30, 11 o'clock at night. I went to bed, and I got up at about 3 o'clock in the morning to go to the restroom, and I noticed that they were still on the phone talking. So that's how conversant both she and her sister are. But that's the kind of people they were, wonderful, small-town, faithful, decent people.
It sounds a little bit like the St. Augustine, who says, preach the gospel at all times, and when absolutely necessary, use words. And you were being very drawn to the gospel, whether you knew it or not, just by observing them, watching their behavior, seeing how they treated people. And it sounds like that was planting some seeds. When did they
Bill,
start?
That is so accurate.
Yeah.
And I think, and that's the same about my wife, too. Same.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then when did you start having it articulated to you? When did you start having the faith story or the gospel presented in a way that was words that you could put in your heart and start kicking around in your head?
Well, when Becky made the ultimate compromise in expressing a willingness to marry me, there were conditions. And one of them was if we were to raise a family, which we both wanted, that I had to start to attend church with her because she wanted to make sure that our kids were raised, in a faithful house. So I agreed to do it. I had no intention of paying attention when I went to church. I was just willing to physically be there.
Mm-hmm.
We went dutifully every week, and I really spent most of those early years going to church thinking about things that were very different from what was happening in the service itself. I never connected with the message of the day, and it wasn't because I was, you know, that the pastors weren't good. It was just simply that I didn't have any interest yet.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't until later on that things started to change, and there was a variety of circumstances that led to that. But, you know, in those early years, I would just say I was physically there, but nothing else.
Yeah. Was your wife showing grace and patience, or was she feeling a little frustration because obviously you weren't absorbing much or weren't entirely paying attention?
I don't remember her, ever expressing, anything to me that was negative. I think she was relieved to start with that I at least had made the first step. So mm-hmm. she's not one to criticize very often. She's always been an encourager, and that has worked with me because I think had she taken a different path, I probably would have pushed back.
Mm-hmm.
So God, you know, clearly had the right woman in mind when this happened because the way that she sort of played this out was the only way that it would have worked mm-hmm. for me.
Paul, you said there were a couple circumstances that changed things. What were those?
Well, I think I would say there was a couple of things that happened sort of in the same time frame. First of all, we had, in 1991, we had our first child, our oldest son, Tucker. And then a year later, we were pregnant with number two. And so I think there was a part of me that was saying, you know, maybe I had to grow up one of these days. I'm about to have two kids. So I think there's something that sort of happens with that. Two awesome kids, by the way. And then we also, I was flying at this point in time, and I had a really extraordinary event in the airplane that was a significant experience for me. And then the third piece was we were church shopping because the pastor of the church that we were attending had been removed, and so we sort of out of protest decided that we would go somewhere else. But, you know, that wasn't a big deal to me really honestly at the time because, I wasn't paying that much attention anyway. But we transitioned over to a church where I started to hear a message that connected with me as well. So it was a combination of things that started to, kind of percolate and the journey began.
George, this sounds like a very interesting formula.
Yes.
Yeah, we're just going to take a short break.
Well, we're going to talk about the plane when we come back, aren't we?
We're going to start with the plane.
Okay.
Then we're going to go to the two kids, and then we're going to circle back to the message from the pastor. You're listening to Real Recovery with Bill Arnold and George Fraser on Faith Radio. Thanks for being with us tonight. We're awfully glad you're aboard. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Nice to have you aboard. This is Real Recovery with Bill Arnold and George Fraser.
That's Neil Young. It's not a British guy, but okay. Good call.
Yeah, that's all right.
I like the accent.
Yeah, I don't do accents, George. I should tell you that up front. Bill Arnold with George Fraser, who is a lot more interesting in his own head. But we're here tonight with a
lot of stuff going on in my head. I want to get back to the Paul Walser. That was very funny, but me.
Hamster activity up there, isn't
it? Yeah, that wheel's going around.
Yep. We're talking to Paul Walser tonight, and he was just setting up the idea that he had two fine sons, Tucker and Campbell, and that he also had an incident with an airplane, which we're going to hear about in just a second. And then eventually, after going to church for many years and not really connecting, he started connecting. And he has a history of being like a lot of people, had a little drinking experience in college, and that is, I got a wake-up moment.
Yeah, but he knew how to, pick his spots.
Oh, absolutely. He was doing it.
A spot picker.
Yeah,
well,
exactly.
I mean, there was some control there. When it becomes 11 o'clock and you've got to work the next day, I learned this the hard way. Some people actually go home so they can make it to work the next day, and you were one of those guys.
I was one of those guys.
So let's go to the airplane incident.
Well, to clarify, at the time of the airplane incident, my wife was pregnant with Campbell, our second son, so he was not yet born. But I had a little Cessna Skyhawk, and the plane was up in Brainerd, where we had a lake home, and it was over at the Breezy Point airstrip, which is basically just a grass strip. And some bad weather was coming in, and so the plane wasn't secure. They didn't have tie-downs or hangars at that airport. And so I told my wife that we needed to move the plane over to the Brainerd airport and get it secured. So I watched the weather reports, and it appeared as though there was an adequate amount of space between the ground and where the bad weather was so that I could run the plane down low underneath the weather system and scoot it over to the Brainerd Airport. I was a VFR pilot only, so I was allowed to fly only when you had visual reference. I did not have an instrument rating, so I wasn't certified or capable of flying by the gauges at that point. So as long as the weather was nice, I could fly. So anyway, she dropped me off over there, and then she went to the Brainerd Airport to wait for me over there with the plane. So I got in the airplane and I took off, and almost immediately I was engulfed in the clouds. I was completely screwed up in terms of how much room I thought I had. Ceilings were way, way, way lower. And so anyway, I couldn't see almost from the moment I took off. The rain's hitting the windshields. I'm completely confused. And you get oftentimes in a condition like that, you get what's known as vertigo, where you become completely disoriented. And so your immediate belief is that the plane is in a very different configuration than what it really is. And I was warned of this. I had had very good flight training, but I was not prepared for how that feeling was. And I literally can remember that the very first thing I thought was, I just want to die and get it over with, because you just don't feel like you've got any chance at all. And something happened where something that I never really knew was in me, where all of a sudden I got composed and I focused on the gauges like I had been taught. Even though I hadn't had the instrument training, they do drill it into your head to pay attention and trust the gauges. So I did that, and I started to climb, and I eventually started to hook up with the Brainerd Tower there, and I told him what was going on, and I was panicked and literally almost in a, just like a tense sort of crying state as I'm talking to the guy. And he did a good job of trying to calm me down. And so he was going to try to figure out how to guide me out of this mess. And in the meantime, I just kept climbing, hoping that I would climb on top of the storm. And so I kept climbing and climbing and climbing. And at about 9,000 feet, I got into what would be the teeth of this storm. And, I mean, it was tossing this little airplane around like I can't even describe to you. And I'm just sweating, and it's hard to hold the plane in a proper configuration. I mean, you're just bouncing all over, and I can't see, and it's just really uncomfortable. But I kind of got through that, and it was about, I can't remember exactly, but it was, you know, somewhere kind of maybe 12, 13, 14,000 feet where I finally popped out on top. But I didn't have any oxygen in the plane, and so that whatever the altitude was, I wasn't able to stay there long because I didn't have oxygen, so I had to get back down. And in the meantime, the Brainerd Tower was trying to find give me a compass heading to determine a path so I could find an airport and get back down. Well, the other problem that I had is I didn't have much fuel left. So I had one tank that was gone, and then I had a second one. He asked me how much fuel you got, and I said, you know, maybe I got a fifth of a tank max in the second tank. So anyway, he said, well, you got to get back down because you can't stay up there without oxygen. So he gave me a compass heading, and I said he'll get back to me with some more flight instructions. So I went right back down into the mess again, into the teeth of the storm, and leveled out at about 7,000 feet. And I'm just flying a compass heading now in the clouds, and I'm cruising along. And he said that they were waiting for PIREPs, pilot reports, to come in to give me some indication as to where I have to go to get out of this storm. Well, this storm was everywhere. There was no getting out of it, and there was certainly nothing within, you know, the fuel range that I had to come even close. So anyway, another maybe 20, 25 minutes goes by, and we're kind of running out of ideas. And I am really down to a very limited amount of fuel. And then... literally the most incredible thing I can ever remember happens. I'm literally flying along, and I get to a hole in the sky where I can see the ground. So I'm at about 6,000 or 7,000 feet, and it's like a big giant hole. So I tell the guy, I said, you know, there's like a hole here, in the sky. And he said, can you bank the plane and get down through the hole? And I said, I don't know. I think maybe I can. So I bank the plane as tight as I can, and I start spiraling down, not in a configuration that would put me into a spin, but a wide enough one to where I could go down. And down I'm going through this thing, and I'm going, gosh, I can't even believe this. And so I get down, and when I get to about maybe 1,500 to 2,000 feet, at the very bottom of the hole is a grass airstrip, sitting in the middle of nowhere. So I said to the guy in the airport, I go, well, you're not going to believe this, but there's an airstrip here. And so he's going, okay. So I get down. I go into turn onto a final path, and I slide right in and drop the plane on this grass field. And I literally got out of the plane and kissed the ground, and sitting here, and I couldn't even believe that this was going on, that this happened. The very next day, I sent the flight instructor, and I'll get back to the end of the story in a second, but the next day, I sent the flight instructor up because I was so shook up, I couldn't get the plane myself, so I asked my instructor to bring the plane back. He goes up, couldn't start it. There was no fuel left at all.
Oh, wow.
So the combination of a hole in the sky, an airstrip sitting there, and literally running out of fuel, that's the kind of wake-up call I needed. I wasn't the guy that, you know, was going to react to something normal in his life. I had to have something like that.
Lord, give me a sign, any sign.
Yeah, just something.
Just any sign, Lord.
Did that do it then? Did you start?
Well, I started to, you know, I mean, I know enough about myself to know that I didn't have, first of all, the inner strength to deal with the issue that I was facing. I I am not the guy that you want to give the ball to with 3 seconds to go in the game tied. You know, I've never been that guy. And so for me to all of a sudden kind of rally and successfully navigate this thing from a personal level was hard to imagine. And then all the other circumstances were incredible on top of it.
What was it like thinking you were going to die?
I don't know that I can honestly tell you that. What I would say to you is I had concluded I was going to, and once I had decided that, I just wanted it to be over with. That's what I remember. And then that's when that other feeling came in that just kind of kicked in. One of the things that happens when you have an accident or a situation like that is the The FAA makes you go, it's an emergency, and so you have to go into their offices, and they replay the entire tape, the transcript of your communication with the tower. And the second thing they do is they give you a similar one from somebody who died. So I listened to a young couple who was flying over to Wisconsin to the air show, a young guy and his girlfriend, and they went into a spin and died. And then the next thing they do is they hand you an article that says 90 seconds to live. And that is the average time that an IFR or a VFR-rated pilot only lives when they get into a condition like that. So it is highly unusual to survive in any circumstance, much less to be in a circumstance where you go through a hole and find an airstrip. So it was a real wake-up call. It really was. And I started to think, you know, there's something going on in my life that's greater than me. And clearly this was a big sign. By the way, my wife was at the Brainerd Tower. They had let her in, and she was listening to this entire communication. Now, she's standing there with our one-year-old, and she's pregnant with the second one. And there were a number of occasions during that communication with the tower where I just said to the guy, I'm afraid, I'm going to die, you know. And so what little did I know that she's listening to this? And a guy that was also there turned to her, not knowing that it was her husband, and he said, "That guy is an idiot. He has no chance."
That
he was right
helpful.
About the idiot thing, but I wasn't able to get the other part done. So anyway, so that's a condensed version of a story that was an incredible experience.
What a great story.
It's a great story.
God's coming through. I mean, what are the odds of there's the landing strip. I don't have any gas, and it's just there.
Yeah. Yeah, nobody could pull that off.
So you joined the church the next day and became a committed Christian? No?
You know, I was a guy that needed God to hit me over the head with a 2x4.
I would say that was it.
That was a pretty good start. But
no,
it was,
he's probably just going to be a better guy now, you know? I mean, well, let's not go overboard. No?
I think what happened was Campbell was born in 1992, or 93, rather, excuse me, February of 1993. And so that was sometime maybe 6 months prior, probably in the early fall of late fall of 92. And so I didn't come to faith until 1997. So there was still another 5 years for
Interesting.
Me, beyond that.
Why don't you hold that thought, and we'll get back into that. I have to clean the sweat off my back from listening to that story. I got to do some mopping up over here. But we're going to be back in one more segment with Paul Walter. We're so glad you joined us tonight on Real Recovery. Be back in a minute.
All is well again.
Welcome back to Real Recovery. So glad you joined us tonight. George, when Paul was talking about vertigo, a little bit like our show. Show is in a very different configuration than what we think it is.
True.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, I want to get back to that because that didn't do it.
No. No, it did not. It was a wake-up call, but it wasn't enough.
Yeah.
So, Paul, what happened in the next block of years? What was going through your head?
Well, I think what that did was at least got me to be a more willing listener and a more of an active participant. And so I don't remember exactly the dates that we started going attending a different church, but I went to a church, and the pastor there was particularly effective at apologetic teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And that really resonated with me. I was interested in it because it was more of an approach to faith that was built on, you know, sort of evidence and facts and circumstance, the kind of things that I think really resonate with me. There was a lot of that type of teaching that he did, and he had done a number of series that were on tape that I started to listen to because I was really captivated by the idea that there might actually be evidence that supports the whole existence of Jesus and the truth of the Bible and the like. And so I started to listen more. I started to have a personal relationship with the pastor. We started meeting for lunch regularly, and that went on for a number of years. I actually went on a missions trip to Peru. Still didn't have faith yet, and I was actually put up on the stage with the other people that were on that trip and asked to speak to about, I don't know how many thousands of people down there. And, of course, I'm sitting up there, you know, at the podium just frozen because I have absolutely no idea what to say to these people. But anyway, it was a long journey. It was 5 years of attending a church, lunches with the pastor, conversations with people, reading books, several of them on apologetics. And then finally on July 3rd of 1997, I made a faith proclamation, and of all places, I did it in a car, which I think seems appropriate.
That's appropriate.
For me, yeah, so.
What were the circumstances?
I would say that there were a number of people that were influencing me, but one of them certainly was the pastor, and I had just finished lunch with him, and I turned to him and I said, I'm ready. And he goes, ready for what? I said, I'm ready to commit my life to Christ. I realized that I told him, I said, I know this has taken you way too long, but I'm there, I'm ready. The facts are aligned. There can be no mistake about this. I need this. I'm ready. Let's go. So we went out in my car and I made a faith commitment, and that was the beginning of a new chapter in my life.
Cool. So how has that changed your life?
I don't have enough time in this program to tell you the impact of that.
Hang on a second. Alex, let's do four more hours. Just bump it up. Go
okay,
ahead.
We're good. We got four hours to go.
I just bought us four more hours.
Yeah, okay, perfect.
Yeah, there we go.
It changes the way that you approach your professional life. It changes the way you approach your personal life. It changes your parenting. It changes your role as a husband. It changes how you look at relationships. It changes everything. And I think that you had actually indicated to me that was a question you might ask. And so it was the only one that I actually thought about a little before I came out here tonight. And I think one thing that has been, at least in my case, has changed, if I was to name a particular thing, it would be in terms of how it affected my thinking. I went from short-term thinking to long-term thinking. Everything in my life up until that time, professionally and personally, was done for the moment. And in fact, the business that I'm in is a business that thrives on 30-day business cycles. You know, how many did you sell last month? What'd you make last month? What'd you do last month? You know, kind of, and you're always sort of, you know, recharging your batteries and starting up every month all over again. And in all those years with business, we never really started asking ourselves the question about what do we want to be in 5 years and in 10 years and what matters. And in your personal life, you know, what really are the long-term goals from an eternal perspective? And how do you want to have people think of you and your life here, and what does it mean to approach things based on eternal life as opposed to a temporary life? And so that was, I think, something that I'm not going to tell you that I've mastered this, by the way, but I do believe that there is a component to a faith journey that invites a much more long-term perspective in any aspect of your life, and that's profoundly changed me.
That's really interesting. So it affects the way you act towards your family, your employees, your customers. It's not just a partial deal. It's your whole life, isn't it?
It really is. It is. And, you know, and I still, you know, there are a lot of moments where I feel like I come up well short of the kind of thinking that God would prefer. But I know I'm forgiven, and I get back and regroup, and I'm thankful for grace, and we just keep moving forward. It was the beginning of a wonderful journey, George.
Well, and I hope it has a long way to go. One of the things that I'm interested in, Paul, you were a guy that had a lot of success along the ways. You had some scary times, obviously the airplane incident. What would you say to some of our listeners who might be out there and their life's pretty good and they know about God, but, you know, really haven't made a decision? Can you say anything to encourage them that might be helpful to them?
I don't know of any way that you can be fulfilled in the absence of Christ in your life. And what I would tell you is that I always believed when I was younger that if I was successful, that if I had wealth, that if I had a great wife and great kids, that that would be sufficient. I was given, you know, reasonable skill sets in terms of being able to be financially successful. I was very fortunate in meeting an extraordinary wife. We've got five kids that are incredible. But that's just not enough. And so I would just say that there is no journey in the absence of God that will give you the sense of fulfillment and the confidence of the future that you can get by accepting Christ.
Cool. Billy, I was just thinking how grateful I am tonight that I've known Paul most of my life, and we took a lot of different roads to get here, and how grateful I am that God allowed us to stay alive and come to his sense in our life to have really fulfilled lives. And I'm glad we reconnected. You blessed my walk a lot tonight with your story, Paul. So it's fabulous.
It is fun to reconnect, George. And I can tell this to your listeners that you and I both needed a lot of help, didn't we, George, back in the old days? And
still
and,
do.
And it's so awesome to see where you've come in your life too. I'm encouraged for you and thankful to reconnect.
Thank you. Billy?
Well, it's a great story, Paul.
Gosh.
I really love moments that are so defining in people's lives. I mean, that story about the plane will never go away in your brain. You will never be able to make that disappear from your conscience. And there's something that God was saying at the time, do I have your attention now?
Yeah.
And he didn't quite, but that was part of the process. And I think it's always so encouraging to have stories of transformation of people that have found Christ, and it happened in God's perfect timing. I'm sure perhaps your wife was hoping that you would have made a decision earlier or whatever, but you made the decision at the exact time God led you to understand truth and brought truth to your head and heart, and that's when it happened. July 3rd. Happy holiday.
Indeed. It would have never happened had I not met my wife, I don't think. So I think God knew that I needed to have an extraordinary woman and I needed some extraordinary circumstances, because I'm just dumber than most.
Well, you're in good company here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good company.
You know, I was just thinking, the plane goes down, we're not safe there. I mean, not this life. I'm talking about the big deal.
Right.
Wow. But God knows what he's doing, Bill, and we have an all-sovereign God, that my next breath comes at the mercy of an all-sovereign God. And he had a plan for your life when he knitted you in the womb, Paul. And, you know, we don't know how our days are numbered, but he had a plan for you, and it's cool, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just awesome.
Paul, Ephesians 6:4 says, fathers, do not exasperate your children. Instead, bring them up in the training and instruction of the Lord. How is parenting?
How is parenting?
Yeah. Yeah. Six kids is a bundle.
You know, five is a great thing. Well, I think, obviously, you know, there are trying moments, as all parents know, but our kids are extraordinary. They are such a joy to me, and they're all so different. I don't know how to answer that other than to tell you that's just been an unbelievable blessing in my life.
Any of your kids like we were?
Well, I do have some that, you know, that are, you know, show that they have a little of me
the
in them, and I'm concerned,
yeah,
about the ones. The ones that are much more like Becky, I think, are going to have a little easier path.
Oh gosh!
They're all great.
Well, as we wrap things up for this hour, I want to thank you, Paul, for coming on and telling your story.
By the way, I would add to you that it's interesting that you picked that verse, because Ephesians is my favorite book.
Excellent. See, George?
Bill knew that.
I knew that. Giorgio, one last time, this weekend of Thanksgiving, what are you thankful for?
Salvation, sobriety, family.
Yep.
You. Sorry, I should have put that first.
Well,
no, just we get a chance to do that. Bill, I'm really grateful for what God has done in my life.
No kidding.
Bottom line.
Yeah. It's
How about you?
Well, I'm grateful for, I don't suffer with addiction like you did, so I don't have sobriety, but certainly, you know, my salvation is first and foremost, because without that, there's nothing. I think people oftentimes ask the wrong first question. They say, will God help me do this? And I think the biggest question to ask is Jesus who he says he was? Because if he is, then you've got the real Savior.
You bet.
So I'm grateful that I know him and I love him, and hopefully I can continue to serve him with shows like
this.
Well,
as you always say, Jesus loves you and he kind of likes me.
Well, so. He just likes you as a friend.
Thank
Alex,
you.
Thanks for your good work tonight.
Thank you.
We're glad you joined us, Paul. Thanks. As always, I will see you all next week on board. Good night.